It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the show, we'll look at new proposed regulations for trains that move hazardous fuels throughout the United States.
First, we're taking a look at a nationwide problem. U.S. jails are, in effect, filling the role of mental health facilities because of the influx of mentally ill inmates. The Associated Press reports that in some jails across the country, more than 20% of the inmates suffer from a mental illness. And it's not just jails. The criminal justice system as a whole is overwhelmed with mental health cases.
John Snook is with us to discuss the problem and some possible solutions. He's Deputy Executive Director of Governmental Affairs for the Treatment Advocacy Center. John, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you.
So how widespread a concern is this, people with mental illnesses ending up in jail?
I think it's a national problem. Communities across the country are really struggling with how do we best treat those who have a severe mental illness? Because unfortunately, in far too often, we are failing.
And often the treatment or the first point of contact for someone with a mental illness is with law enforcement and the criminal justice system. How did we end up there?
Unfortunately, there have been a number of pieces that have combined to get us into the predicament that we're in today. One of the biggest pieces is the elimination of inpatient psychiatric beds. What started out as a very good idea as a way to deinstitutionalize and ensure that people were able to get treatment in the community really ended up in a position where we just don't have enough psychiatric beds in the community. There's a longstanding federal rule known as the IMD exclusion, which basically says that Medicaid is unable to reimburse for facilities that would exist as an inpatient facility to provide psychiatric care. So what that means in reality is there just aren't enough hospital beds for those who need that sort of crisis care in an inpatient facility.
And getting into the history, as I understand it, there was a move, as you mentioned, to deinstitutionalize, move away from these large psychiatric hospitals, gradually close those down, but replace it with a network of community-based mental health centers. That network never really came about as people had envisioned, did it?
That's exactly right. Unfortunately, we never really invested in a system of community care in a way that we needed to. And that combined with standards that we changed to ensure that people really were only able to get care when they were dangerous to themselves or others meant that those who need something more than voluntary care were really only going to get it when they were either dangerous or placed in a facility, a jail or a prison.
Well, let's walk through that scenario now. Someone becomes a danger to themselves or others. Somebody calls the police. Police, do they have training to deal with people with whose behavior is the result of mental illness?
There are a number of initiatives that have been implemented. The most famous is what's known as CIT, or Crisis Intervention Training. It stemmed out of the Memphis, Tennessee area. After a number of tragedies, the law enforcement officers there recognized that they needed to do something more because they were dealing with so many of these cases. And what that program does is basically takes a number of steps to ensure that law enforcement officers understand what they're dealing with when they're trying to provide care to someone who's seriously mentally ill. And steps like not approaching them in the same manner that they would a normal person that may not have a mental illness, or recognizing that that person may not respond to commands in the same way that they would expect from someone that they would typically deal with. And then they also do a number of steps on the other side of trying to help law enforcement officers not have to take so much of their time dealing with mental health issues. So at the end of the day, what that means is providing systems that allow a law enforcement officer to be able to get that person into a hospital or into a crisis center without having to have them take them to a jail. And Wisconsin has actually taken a number of steps to institute those sort of crisis stabilization locations, mobile crisis response teams, crisis intervention programs. And basically what that allows a police officer to do is to find a person who needs care, get them into that care, and not have to take them to jail. Because what a law enforcement officer would typically have to do is sit with that person for a number of hours in an emergency room, in an inpatient facility, until they got care otherwise. And after a police officer has done that four or five times, they simply aren't going to take that person to the facility because they don't have the time. So that person's going to end up in a jail. So these programs step in and say, we have a better way of doing this, and we're going to get that person care without taking all of your time.
Well, that sounds like a good step, but I can't imagine anyone, a police officer, someone with a mental illness, a social worker, anybody thinks the best system is for the police officer to be the person handling a mental illness issue. The police officers would say, that's not our job, it's not what we're trained for. Are there steps being taken to jump in before it's the police officer having to make this decision, having to take someone to the jail or to a treatment center or something like that?
That's exactly right. And that is the biggest message that we hope to get out there, is that all of the training in the world doesn't make sense when you're having a law enforcement officer have to provide care. That's simply not what they're set up for. That's not what our jails and prisons are designed to do. And if you are in a situation where you're having to train law enforcement officers to provide care, you've failed, even if you give them the best possible training, because that's simply not their job. Wisconsin has taken one of the most important steps, which is to make sure that your standard for when you can provide someone care recognizes the reality of mental illness. In Wisconsin, if you are a person who has a severe mental illness, the state is going to be able to provide you care if, beyond just that standard of, are you dangerous, are you going to hurt someone or hurt yourself, Wisconsin goes farther and says, is your illness causing you to be unable to understand that you need care? And if you are unable to understand that you need care, are you deteriorating in a way that's going to mean that you need care right now? And so it's similar to what is done for other illnesses. It's getting rid of that artificial distinction between a mental illness and a regular illness to say, are you able to understand that you're sick? Are you having hallucinations that make you think that instead of your illness, it's the CIA who's talking to you? If that is happening, Wisconsin is able to step in and say, we're going to provide you care until you get to a point that you're able to make those decisions voluntarily. In far too many situations around the country, when a family member starts to deteriorate in that way, what they're told when they call their local hospital or their local police force is, we can't do anything until they're dangerous, until they hurt you or hurt someone else. So families are basically left to wait and hope that when their loved one hurts someone, it's someone within the family, and they're able to call and get care at that immediate moment. And it's just not a system that makes sense for severe mental illness, or really for any situation.
Under our current system, a lot of times after that contact with law enforcement, a person with mental illness ends up in jail for some period of time while people figure out what to do, while they wait for a court date. They may be in jail again and again. How bad is jail as a setting to temporarily house someone with a mental illness?
It is quite simply the worst possible place for someone with a severe mental illness. In every instance that you can think of, a mental illness is going to make treatment and their stay in a jail or a prison worse. Things like being victimized by other prisoners, being involved in being placed in solitary confinement, increased costs for the facility itself. Basically, every situation that you can think of in a jail or prison is made worse by having a severe mental illness.
We're talking to John Snook of the Treatment Advocacy Center about the number of mental health cases overwhelming all parts of the criminal justice system here in the United States.
And you can join the conversation. Are you a law enforcement officer who's dealing with mental health issues in your community? How are you handling that issue? Or if you're a social worker, what are you seeing in your local jails? Do you know someone with a mental illness who's had to deal with the criminal justice system? What happened? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email at talk@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation with John Snook of the Treatment Advocacy Center about the number of mental health cases overwhelming the criminal justice system in the United States.
And you can join the conversation. Are you in law enforcement? Do you have to deal with mental health issues in your community while you're on the job? How do you handle that? If you're a social worker, what do you see going on in your line of work? Or do you know someone with a mental illness who's had to deal with the criminal justice system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. John, I wanted to talk to you about courts. Now, somebody with a mental illness comes into contact with the police, ends up in court. What kind of options are there for the courts, apart from sending people to prison? Are we seeing new initiatives around the country?
We are. One of the most promising pieces that we're seeing is a program known as Mental Health Courts. And it is pretty self-explanatory, does what it sounds like. It's a specialized court that steps in and diverts folks from the criminal justice system and says, we are going to take into account your mental illness, and we are going to provide you care rather than incarcerating you. And what you find around the country is that these programs save communities money and provide more effective care than you would see that person getting in an actual jail or prison.
So they can they mandate treatment? And is that a concern of imposing maybe a medical treatment on someone?
That is one of the key pieces of mental health courts, is that they can mandate treatment. And what we find is that they provide more effective care than you would see in a jail or prison. And then the reality is there are very specific protections, due process protections, that are built into the process before someone is provided or mandated to participate in treatment. But the reality is that treatment is going to benefit the person. And if they meet those due process standards that they need care, this is a much better outcome than having them be incarcerated for, at the end of the day, what isn't really a crime but a symptom of their illness.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Marie on the line in Spooner. Marie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I came onto your program a little bit late, but I did hear something that's very, very familiar to me, and I just want to tell you about an incident. I have an adult son who has a variety of mental illnesses. He's had over 25 inpatient psych hospitalizations, and I've never been able to get him in until, like your guest said, he was a danger to himself or others. He was at this point in a residential home, a treatment center, like a home-based thing. And at one point, he had an altercation. This happened a few months ago. And the person just was angry with him and didn't want to give him his meds. And in anger, he walked out and just slammed the door and said, I'll be back. He wanted to just walk it off. But he didn't realize that he broke the glass in the door that he slammed. And so instead of calling a crisis worker or his case manager, they called the police. And the police found him, tracked him down, handcuffed him, took him for fingerprinting, and he's never been in trouble with the law before. And it was just handled so poorly. And I talked with his attorney and just said, you know, this isn't a crime. This isn't about a person who's done something against the state or, you know, it's just he didn't know what else to do. He actually left and slammed the door to walk to his case manager's office for help. And they just didn't care. And the attorney said to me, well, I understand, but, you know, we just have to keep with what he was charged with. And so now he has a record with disorderly conduct or whatever it is.
Marie, thanks a lot for the call. I wanted to get John in on this. Not, I think, an uncommon story, John. Does that kind of crisis intervention training you were talking with for police help prevent unnecessary escalation?
I think that's one of the key aspects of those sort of programs is being able to step in the middle and help someone who may be having psychotic symptoms or maybe escalating, treating them in a different way than you would typically train a police officer to respond to that person. And that, we find, is very effective for dealing with those sort of situations that all too often end up in the sort of tragedies you see on the front page.
But John, I wonder, I mean, even a trained a police officer who's gone through this kind of crisis training, when they walk into a situation, they don't necessarily know the mental health history of the person they're dealing with. All they've got is what they're observing. How do you overcome that?
And that is the hardest piece of this. And the reality is that all the mental health training in the world is not going to address those sort of situations where a law enforcement officer has to make a split-second decision and the person may be threatening them or threatening someone else. And the key really is making sure that we don't let people deteriorate to the point that they may be dangerous to themselves or dangerous to someone else. And unfortunately, in many states, the laws just haven't kept up with our medical knowledge. And what we find now, I think, makes a lot of sense, but it's a little bit of a delay in the actual laws. So what happens for a lot of people who have a severe mental illness is that the illness impacts their ability to understand that they're sick. And so what happens is rather than being able to understand that they need care, the concern is, well, the CIA is after me or someone is poisoning my food. And no matter how many times you try to reason with that person, because it's their brain that's being impacted by the illness, they're never going to be able to understand that. It's a similar problem you see in someone who's had a stroke. And so for those folks, no amount of voluntary care is ever going to be enough because they don't think that they're ill. And so the state needs to have the ability to step in, provide care to that person until they are able to make a voluntary decision. And in far too many states across the country, what happens is that person is left to deteriorate again until they're a danger. And that's when law enforcement has to step in. And in those situations, you hope that they've been trained with crisis intervention training and these other steps. But the reality is it's the worst possible situation for a law enforcement officer to step into. And all the training in the world is just going to make a bad situation a little better. But it's not the situation we want to have to put law enforcement officers in.
Marie, good luck to you and your son. We'll go now to Josh in Rice Lake. Josh, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. The story you're talking about, it sounds a lot like my brother-in-law. For years, he was in and out of the court system. And then in Barron County, he ended up getting really lucky. He ended up with a mental health caseworker where he was mandated to go get his shots to control his mental illness. And since he had the caseworker, things have really started to improve for him. When he has episodes, the family contacts the caseworker instead of the police, and they can bring him in and talk to him, and they can make a decision whether he gets hospitalized again or not. I can't say enough for the benefit of the caseworkers, the mental health caseworkers, using them instead of law enforcement. And I'll take the comments off there.
Josh, thank you so much for bringing that up. John, I was wondering about that. So many people, the first call sometimes is to the police. How important is it, at least in a non-violent episode situation, is it to have someone else to be that first call a family makes?
That can be very helpful. The National Alliance for Mental Illness, if there's a crisis intervention team in your city or in your county, and those sort of mental health assessment units can all be very helpful. I think, obviously, if you're worried about the situation, it does make sense to call law enforcement in. Hopefully, they will be partnering with those groups and can bring someone along from either the National Alliance for Mental Illness or from some of the crisis diversion teams. But at the end of the day, Wisconsin is in a really good situation. There are a number of these sort of alternatives and options for both mental health professionals and law enforcement to get people care that they need. So you are in a much better position than in a lot of states around the country.
And briefly, are these ideas catching on in those other states?
They are. I was actually just in Virginia testifying there about some of the changes that they are looking to, and one of the examples that I provided was Wisconsin standard. And Virginia has for many, many years been one of those states that relied on solely, is someone in imminent danger? They've moved beyond that recently since the Virginia Tech tragedy, but there's a recognition that they need to do more. And one of the places they're looking to is Wisconsin, because Wisconsin has taken a much more medically focused situation, much more medically focused analysis of how to treat mental illness.
John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's John Snook. He's Deputy Executive Director of Government Affairs for the Treatment Advocacy Center. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Congress heads to a month-long recess at the end of next week, and their solution to the influx of migrants at the border appears to be at an impasse.
First, the federal government announced today that they're seeking stricter rules for rail cars that transport flammable fuels throughout the United States. The suggested regulations come amid a domestic energy boom, which has seen an increase in train cars carrying hazardous liquids like crude oil and ethanol. That's also led to several high-profile derailments in the U.S. and Canada.
Earlier this month, WPR News reported that rail companies in the state are transferring substantial train loads of volatile Bakken crude oil through 18 Wisconsin counties at an average of 45 times per week. So new regulations could have particular interest here in the state.
Mike Simonson joins us now. He's WPR's reporter in Superior. He initially reported those numbers on crude oil coming through the state. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Let's get into what we're hearing from the Federal Department of Transportation when it comes to these rail cars.
Well, there's a few changes that they're trying to get, and probably the most dramatic is slowing the trains down to 40 miles per hour. A lot of the critics of the industry say it should be as low as 20 miles per hour, but they're reducing it from 50 to 40 miles per hour. Another big thing is replacing about 100,000 old tankers. Now, the railroads have been upgrading their tankers, upgrading the design, making them safer since 2011. But as you said, the Bakken oil fields are just going crazy with production doubling just in the last couple of years. So they just can't keep up with making enough new cars. So, which brings us to the third thing, is that the U.S. government wants full compliance by the railroads, these changes in place within 2 years.
And you mentioned the boom in various kinds of fuel production in Canada, the United States. Is that why we're hearing interest in these regulations right now?
Well, there have been 11 fiery explosions in different communities in the past year, including one in Quebec that took the lives of 47 people, another one in Castleton, North Dakota, which took out part of a small town, because this fuel is so volatile. You know, there's a few reasons for it, but one reason is that it has more gases in it, and another is they don't put stabilizer in it that the Texas crude is put into it. So it's really making the headlines, and people now know that these tankers are coming through La Crosse. La Crosse is kind of like Grand Central Station, and it goes across central Wisconsin to Milwaukee and Kenosha counties, or it goes down the western border counties. I think it's a total of 18 Wisconsin counties have this Bakken crude going through. So there is a lot of concern and a lot of publicity, and you know, everybody's kind of looking at tanker cars pretty suspiciously now, especially if it goes through urban or populated areas.
There are a lot of business interests at play here. The companies that are producing the fuel, the rail companies, the people who make the rail cars. What's been some of the response from industry to these proposed regulations?
About a month ago, I was doing a story about the Sandpiper expansion by Enbridge Energy, and they insisted that this fuel is no more volatile than regular crude oil. That was an industry group who came on that, but I think they're backing off on that because every other, including the US DOT, says this is a more volatile fuel. And so the industry says they're going to take a look at it. There's a 90-day comment period, or make it a 60-day comment period for these new rules that the USDOT put out just today. And so I guess we'll see what they're doing. The railroads are trying to do things, but, you know, this is really an incredible story. The amount of production that's coming out of Bakken and also Alberta has just doubled and tripled. It was they reached a million barrels of oil a day just last month.
Well, you described for us the path that some of this cargo is taking through Wisconsin, and you reported on this based on your open records request. Does the public, for the most part, know what is coming through their area?
I think a lot of the emergency governments, the first responders, know when and where specifically. There are maps that are now going out, but I think communities really want to know, is there a way that it can be rerouted around it? And this USDOT order asks for other routes when possible to get out of populated areas. But it is so explosive, and it is that you cannot, that once it is on fire, you can't put it out any other way except with foam, or you got to let it burn. And that's what happened in Castleton. They just had to let it burn. You couldn't get close enough to fight that fire. So it's, you know, it's got the potential to take out half a town. And if it's going through a downtown area, if it's going through a neighborhood in La Crosse, yes, folks are going to be pretty concerned.
And I gather that when you filed the records request to find out what was coming through Wisconsin and where it was going, rail companies objected to that. So do you know why they did?
Well, they're trying to keep things. They're saying it's a business secret, and they're calling it a homeland security thing so terrorists can't get it. But they're not saying that exact time the trains are going through, and individual state governments, including Wisconsin's emergency management, decided that the public safety far outweighs the interests, the private interest, the industry secrets of the railroads. But yeah, the railroads, in their letters disclosing to emergency government of each state, had a threat at the end. The last paragraph was, if you do release this, we are going to take legal action against you.
Now, these new rules are coming from the federal government. Have you heard any response from Wisconsin's congressional delegation on these issues?
Yeah, Congressman Ron Kind has been kind of out front in trying to get more money from the feds for more track inspectors. And Congress was successful in getting another $500,000, which is a bit more than a drop in the oil bucket as far as getting people to be inspecting tracks. He says what the DOT wants happening in the next 2 years, the industry's already been moving in that direction. He would like to see more track inspections, and he would also like to see more track replacement. And he would also like to see that stabilizer that I mentioned a little earlier put in this oil so it isn't so volatile. And that would have to happen in Bakken at the oil fields itself before it even hits the rail lines.
You just mentioned the phrase in the next 2 years for these Department of Transportation regulations. With these rules out today, what happens next? How long would it take to implement them?
Well, it's a 60-day public and rail industry, of course, comment period, and the final rules will come into effect early next year, and then they've got 2 years to meet these.
So we've seen a lot of increased traffic, as you mentioned, of these rail cars carrying this fuel. Are we seeing as much as we're ever going to see, do you think, or are these numbers going to keep going up?
No, it's a crazy story. I mean, I've been doing the Enbridge Energy. They're throwing around billion-dollar figures for either upgrades for their pipelines or for new pipelines. And the rail system is clogged, literally is clogged with oil. So grain shipments from farms can't make it to ports, or coal shipments to electrical co-ops can't make it there. And the Bakken oil fields, that's only one oil field. It's really just part of the Williston oil field, which is a much larger system in the Dakotas. So, yeah, we're seeing just maybe halfway mark, maybe more. I mean, how much can you carry? And that's what the question is now.
So we're going to see increased pressure for more pipelines and more railroad cars coming through.
boy, as fast as they can get them, and as fast as they can build them, and as fast as they can get them permitted and regulated.
We'll leave it there, but I'm sure we're going to come back to this. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, good to talk to you.
That's Mike Simonson. He's WPR's reporter in Superior. Time now for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Last night in Georgia, after a heated race, business executive David Perdue won the runoff in the Republican state primary, Republican Senate primary, I should say. He'll be fighting for one of those seats that Republicans need to take control of the U.S. Senate.
And August recess is quickly approaching, but Congress has reached an impasse on crafting a solution to the tens of thousands of young migrants who are being held at the border. Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. Paul, good to have you back.
Hey, Veronica. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. So last night we saw a pretty close race coming out of Georgia in this runoff election between David Perdue and longtime Georgia Congressman Jack Kingston. Tell us how it shook down last night.
Well, it was not supposed to be this close. We are once again learning that, you know, never trust the polls. The thought was that Kingston had a decent lead in this race. He's very well known. He's been a congressman, as you said, for many years, and is well known in the state, and was heavily funded by the Chamber of Commerce and other sort of, you know, big Republican establishment groups. But he lost in a very narrow result. He lost to a businessman named David Perdue, who's a former Dollar General CEO and is
and Reebok.
He's a family member of the former Governor Sonny Perdue, so also a pretty well-known guy.
So why was it so close?
Well, you know, it's close because they're both, you know, well-known candidates, well-known names. There is still in the Republican Party a great deal of dissatisfaction with almost anybody who has spent quality time in Washington. I think you saw Kingston's tenure work against him in this matter because, again, you say I'm from Washington, and particularly in the Republican Party, where the Tea Party wing looks at you and says, "Well, if you've been there, you've done wrong." Sort of by definition. Now it becomes David Perdue against another famous name in Georgia, the daughter of former Senator Sam Nunn, Michelle Nunn, is a Democratic nominee for a Senate seat that could actually be in play.
Right. This is being watched as a pretty big deal, as Georgia is a state that could tip control of the Senate one way or the other, depending on who comes out on top, Democrats or Republicans.
Right. Well, and you'd assume that Georgia, you know, deep red state, is going to be represented by Republicans. But this is the first time in a long time that Democrats think they might actually have a shot at that seat. Perdue is a bit of an unknown, and he has been involved in businesses that have downsized and moved jobs overseas. At least that's the allegation that Democrats are going to try and play up as much as possible. So who knows what's possible? Again, I'm not going to watch the polls too closely because I'm not sure I believe them.
So is that just you, Paul, or are other political watchers deciding, you know what, look at Eric Cantor, look at this race, maybe we're not going to play so much into the polls this time around?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have a particular vendetta against polling at this point because I'm tired of it. And I say this, you know, as the politics editor at USA Today, where we spend an awful lot of time doing polls. I think that there's a sort of exhaustion factor in the polls. People in the press, we love to do them because they're an instant story. But they don't tell you a whole lot necessarily. After a little while, you've been through them once or twice. Everyone's done another version of the poll. It really doesn't tell you who's going to go out and vote.
But then when the polls are proven wrong, everyone gets to be outraged that the polls were wrong, and then you have another story. Right.
You see how the cycle
it
works.
It keeps going, right. Well, Congress is going to head into a recess, I gather, a month-long recess coming up pretty soon, end of next week. And running up to that recess, it seems as though we are at an impasse. Congress is at an impasse when it comes to passing any kind of deal to deal with the influx of migrants, young migrants at the border. Catch us up to speed on that.
Yes, well, I might take issue with your word of running up to the deadline because, of course, Congress is plodding to their exit. Yeah, the Democrats last night issued their version of the bill in the Senate that would provide $2.7 billion As I think you and I have discussed before, the Obama administration said we have this influx of kids. There's somewhere between 40 and 50,000 kids from Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador arriving at our border and basically turning themselves in. And the administration said we need $3.7 billion to manage this crisis. They're overwhelming the system down there. Well, the Democrats said, well, how about $2.7 billion? And the Republicans are now saying, well, how about maybe something closer to $1.5 billion? But the sticking point here is not the money. The sticking point is going to be the policy change. The administration initially suggested they'd be open to a policy change that would make it easier to deport these kids more quickly, basically send them back where they came from. It's already easy to send people back to Mexico. For these other countries, they basically want to extend that policy. Then the administration backed off and said, well, particularly because a lot of immigration advocates and Democrats were very uncomfortable with the idea of sending these kids back quickly to what could be very dangerous circumstances. So the administration has sort of backed off. The Democrats have said they don't want to do it. And the Republicans are now saying this is the critical component. If we don't get that policy change, we're not going to pass the funding. So we're nowhere, basically, is where we are.
Well, this is not a situation where you can just hit pause and merrily go on your way. I mean, we've got so many kids, as you said, down on the border in detention centers. Something is going to happen. What's going to be the first to give? What do you think?
I don't know. Ask the pollsters. I mean, at what I suspect will happen, but it's just a guess, is that Congress will not get this done this week. They will go on recess, and the administration will begin to sort of reprogram money around from various other things. They will start moving things around. They will conclude that possibly the flow of children has slowed because the message has gotten out, don't send your kids north. And then we'll come back in September and maybe find a way to just pass a, you know, maybe $1 billion worth of money just to sort of stretch them through until November.
That's not going to be the policy change Republicans want, it doesn't sound like.
No. I expect can kicking. Kicking the can is what Congress is good at. But I don't know. I mean, I honestly don't know if there's any way they can figure out a way to get a bill passed that does change these policies. What they may be able to do is just start moving more quickly. I suspect Obama is going to say something in the next couple of days that will speed deportations unilaterally, therefore avoiding Congress having to be involved. That's the kind of thing that you expect to see happen when they can't get Congress to move.
Any chance there'll be any work done in August? Is it even legal for Congress to do that?
Well, sure, but why would they? I mean, at that point, they are in by and large, they go back to their districts. They call it the district work period, which we all think is a joke. But they go back to their districts. Theoretically, they meet with constituents, and they go on vacation. They're not going to do anything in August. They'll be back in September to take up any legislation. Now, I will say, staff are still here. There are still meetings going on. They're still, you know, doing some research on hearings or whatever else they may do in September. But no, they're not going to pass any bills.
Well, let's move to Israel now. Some foreign policy matters on the table. The U.S. still a staunch supporter of Israel throughout this. And the support here seems to cut across party lines, one of the few things that is right now. Why is U.S. support for Israel so staunch in Congress right now?
You know, the issue in Congress remains, and always remains, that Israel is our strongest ally in the region. Period, end of sentence. They are our strongest ally in the region and have been for, you know, many decades. So Democrats can't alienate their base voters. A lot of, you know, they have a lot of Jewish voters. Let me rephrase that. Jewish voters tend to be Democratic supporters, not always, but frequently. No one is going to vote against them. They have a very powerful lobby. And basically, on both sides of the aisle, they look at Israel as a bastion of our foreign policy. In fact, in this border bill you and I were just discussing, the Democrats stuck in $200 extra million for Israeli air defenses as kind of a way to sweeten the pot to get Republicans on board.
And are there any voices out there right now calling for a more nuanced approach to U.S. support of Israel, or is this something that's just sort of monolithic across the board?
Well, I mean, there's always voices calling for nuanced support, and there are some people who would argue that the ban on travel, the ban on travel to Ben Gurion Airport that the FAA issued yesterday amounts to a rebuke of Israel, because it's making, you know, Israel more uncomfortable. It makes travel very, very difficult to and from there. It cuts into tourism, which is, of course, lifeblood for Israel. So you could make the argument that, well, this was the administration trying to very quietly put pressure on Israel to, you know, stop bombing Gaza, essentially. But I don't think that's true. I think they really are concerned about the fact that, particularly in the wake of the airplane that was shot down a week ago, in Ukraine, you don't want to send passenger aircraft into areas where there's missiles being fired.
Going to leave it there. Paul, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks, Veronica. Talk to you soon.
We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time to talk about the latest from Congress.